Welcome, Professor Ilan Pape.
The title of the talk is Gaza as an Epicenter. And I use this metaphor of an epicenter thinking about earthquakes. And the epicenter of an earthquake is usually the place where the worst damage is inflicted, where the collapse of buildings occurs, where the destruction of infrastructure and even relics from the past that were hidden from the eye lay bare before the naked eye. In many ways, I do feel that Gaza, namely the genocide of Gaza, and the international reaction to the genocide, exposed in the starkest way possible as an epicenter what is wrong with the international system that we live in, with international politics, with international morality, with our local politics, as well as with our global politics. It exposed what's wrong with our world, but it also uncovered, and this is where my optimism comes into play, I think it also uncovered, hopefully, a way forward not only for Gaza, for Palestine, or the Middle East, but for the world at large. It's difficult to say this when we have in mind the image of the destruction, of the dead, of the wounded, of the dispossessed, to say that this is a moment from which you can derive any optimism about the future. But I do believe, as an historian, that there are these moments in history where the worst is unfolding before our eyes, but the worst is also hiding deep, deep below a chance for a different kind of reality, because it is so bad, it is so cruel, it is so inhuman that you do hope that it awakes a lot of people who disregarded what happened there or were complicit in what happened there, who might have a different perspective now, unfortunately, or needed a different perspective, unfortunately, when such horrific genocide and ethnic cleansing are being daily televised and they cannot anymore claim ignorance of what's happening. I hope this is not too optimistic, but I do believe, again, from studying history, that there is this connection between a terrible moment and the awakening of what is better in the human, in humanity. Whether it's compassion, whether it's solidarity, whether it is caring for someone and understanding that their fate is also strongly connected to your own fate. Time will tell, of course, if I'm right or not. In my last book, I tried to go even further than that. I imagined how this different future would look like as triggered by the terrible events that we are facing today. Let me enumerate some of the bare realities that this human-made disaster area called the Gaza Strip has laid bare before us. Before doing that, let me preface by saying that the gap between those who recognize these terrible realities that were uncovered in the last 3 years and those who deny them is the gap between saving the Palestinians in the future and allowing the carnage to continue. There is it's the same gap between what you can do or cannot do for the people of Gaza and the way you relate to what you have seen, at least in the last 3 years, and of course, with a deeper understanding of what happened even in a much wider historical concept. Do notice, I did not say the gap between those who see these realities and those who do not see the realities, namely those who are ignorant of them. There's a difference between ignorance and denial. Anyone who has the power, be it even very limited power, to impact positively the reality on the ground in historical Palestine and by extension in the Middle East as a whole, anyone who is belonging to a government or an organization or as an individual who have the power to change the reality on the ground cannot claim ignorance about the most televised genocide of our time and its consequences. I wish it was the case that all we needed is to educate people and inform them of what happens and the implications of what happened. But what we need is not information. The information today is there. What we need is to refer to their morality, humanity, historical responsibility, to their vocation and accountability as politicians. And this is a far more difficult task ahead of us. Unlike members of our society, and I'm talking about society here and society elsewhere in the world, unlike so many members of civil society at large, with whom I engage, and many of you, I'm sure, are engaging in huge numbers, who through their willingness to know what really happened in Palestine since the arrival of Zionism and what unfolded during the Nakba of 1948 and what happened after 1948 in the history which the Palestinians call the ongoing Nakba, were willing to use that information or were prodded by this information to leave behind them their unconditional support in the past for Israel and their loyalty to the Zionist fabrications about the past and accepting the responsibility of their own countries and governments that in their name enabled the dispossession of Palestine and the Palestinians. Unlike these new members of the global solidarity movement that in the last 3 years joined the movement in unprecedented numbers, it seems that for most politicians who have the power to impact reality, the question is not what happened or how terrible it is what happened in Palestine, or even how complicit they are in the catastrophe, but rather they ask themselves, and they keep asking themselves, how dangerous such an acknowledgement is to their careers and electoral future. But we should not despair of enumerating before them these bare realities that the epicenter of the human-made mega earthquake of Gaza had exposed. Here are some of them. Not in the order of importance, not all of them are global, some of them are very local, but all of them are issues that pertain directly to the future of Palestine or to the world at large within a framework that refuses to distinguish between what happens to the Palestinians and other injustices in the world. My computer is sliding, that's why I'm doing these acrobatics. So it's not part of the show, but I hope you don't mind having an extra performance next to the lecture. Let me begin with the collapse of the international legal system. I think that's probably one of the most important consequences. If we talk about Gaza as an epicenter, what happens to our systems in the world, I think it's a good place to start. What happened to international law in the wake of the Gaza genocide? It was built, as you know, in 1945. Probably there were earlier attempts after the First World War to lay the foundation for an international legal system. The wish was to avoid another world war, another Holocaust, to end what the late Eric Hobsbawm called the Age of Extreme, which he rightly claimed continued after 1945. He gave it a later date of duration in 1991, but unfortunately he was not right there. It continued, the Age of Extreme continued after 1991. In many ways, it is still with us in many parts of the world. When the Human Rights Charter was drafted in 1948, and the United Nations was established in 1945 with all the relevant international tribunals which were meant to regulate international law and justice, still much of the world was colonized. And so the analysis behind what was wrong with the world and what should be done in order to overcome the realities of extremism were not done in consultation with the colonized world. The colonizers themselves, in a way, decided what is universal, what is international justice. And that comes back to bite us today, in the way that, for instance, so many people in the global south have little confidence in the international system as a fair system, but rather see it as a very biased idea and system that is not meant to serve them, but to serve what used to be the colonizers' world. The analysis, and you can see it in the analysis, if you look at the documents of 45 to 48, when these people who took upon themselves this sacred mission to create an international system that would make sure that there's no third world war, when you look at their analysis, you can see that when they talk about the charters and convention and organizations that would prevent such a calamity, they point out to communism, to Nazism, to fascism as the causes of extremism. And these ideologies are depicted as the destroyers of the Enlightenment. And so they are absolutely confident that you need to return the 19th century Enlightenment and its principles in order to build a better world. The very same Enlightenment that enabled, without any moral inhibitions, slavery, imperialism, colonialism, and settler colonialism. It was not until 1960 that the possible connection was recognized and internalized in Europe, the connection between the mass Western killing of millions of people in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, in Australia, and the mass killing of Europeans by Europeans, including 6 million Jews. The German slaughtering of people in Namibia had much to do with the Holocaust as anti-Semitism and Nazism. The Anglophile Hitler was inspired by the British mass killing of millions of people in the Indian subcontinent, as he wrote himself. As a result of this recognition, and once physical colonialism came to an end in the 60s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, it was possible for those who were regulating international law in the world to define colonialism, finally, as a violation of international law. But when it was suggested that also settler colonialism, not only colonialism, would be regarded as violation of international law, namely, not only looking at countries that gained independence because the empires collapsed as legitimate victims of international law, but looking at the people who were eliminated in order to enable new countries to become independent, then this was too much for the international system to stomach as part of building a new world. So, not surprisingly, if you look at the discussions about the need to define settler colonialism as a violation of international law, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, in those days South Africa was still under apartheid, and Israel were the most important objection, were the ones who objected most strongly than anyone else to the idea of defining settler colonialism as a crime against humanity and violations of international law. So settler colonialism until today is not recognized as a violation in international law, although at least the United Nations produced recently conventions about the rights of indigenous people. The trajectory that allegedly is making international law more inclusive, for instance, by its reference to colonialism and to indigenous rights, by its condemnation of racism, of apartheid and segregation. This inclusive attitude, for me, is still a comfortable ride for the ex-colonizers. A sorry day in Australia, academics recognizing the native land on which their universities were built. Here and there, a slight revision of textbooks and curricula, unfortunately not in this country. And the symbolic politics of recognition, a lot of symbolic politics of recognition. What Gaza, or the genocide of Gaza, did, it exposed a case study that was very challenging in terms of people's political career, one that demanded a rehaul of the educational system, of reevaluating trade and diplomatic relations with Israel, if indeed the system built in 1945 was to be applied to a settler colonial state that clearly violated international law and should have borne the consequences. Or put differently, the seemingly justified action the West was willing to employ against Iran, North Korea, and Russia, and in the case of the United States, Venezuela, and Cuba, or more individual prosecutions of dictators in Africa or war criminals in Serbia. When all of this, on the basis of a very logical analysis, supported by quite a lot of works of scholars and human rights organization, when all of that had to be employed, or even part of it had to be employed against Israel, the system collapsed. The actions were needed against what in 1948 the international community regarded as the most important act of restorative justice. That is, they saw Israel, within the discussion of building a new world, they saw the establishment of Israel as an act of justice, almost of ultimate justice, for compensating the Jewish people, not only for the Holocaust, but for centuries of anti-Semitism. And how would they compensate the Jews for that? By building a Jewish state in Palestine. Although this should have been realized long before the genocide in Gaza, after it, it's surely something we have to reassess, whether this was a restorative act of justice or whether it was actually a momentous act of injustice against the Palestinian people. Such a drastic reference that we are asking now European politicians to adopt in view of the project that was European at heart, proved too much for the system of international law. Yes, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, rose to the challenge in a way, but the system was built in such a way that at least as a tool to stop a genocide in Gaza or the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the West Bank, it is useless. Even more useless, it is a tool to rectify a momentous historical injustice that continues even more horrifically, with more horrific manifestations today. I've never done so many gymnastics in the last 10 years. That's good. My wife would be happy. Good. This is not only because international law has no teeth or powers of sanctions. I claim that Western indifference and at times complicity towards the genocide in Gaza is the outcome of the project which the West, the EU, Europe in general, and later the United States, conceived, executed, maintained, and protected as an organic project of what they would call the Judeo-Christian civilization. The problem that now in 2026, as in 1882, this project that could be realized, could only be realized with coercion, destruction, and total violation of international law. So how could it be a project of civilization if it needed so much violence to set it, to maintain it, to defend it? The unfolding, escalating violence toward the Palestinians should have triggered a soul-searching journey among those who established the project and still protect it today. A soul-searching journey, as I mentioned, millions of members of the civil society undertook in recent years, but not their politicians. The motive, as I noted, is that too many of them, of the politicians, and I think that's why they are not joining us in what is so clearly necessary, is that so many of them are self-centered. So many of them see politics not as a vocation, but as a career. And as long as such moral stances would be deemed too risky for them in terms of their future, they will do their best either to shun away from taking action or obey obediently, as they do in this country, the pro-Israeli lobby. There were many shields protecting the disinclination of politicians to boldly engage with the project of Zionism as a misguided European solution to the problem of anti-Semitism and as a momentous proportions. Bygones are bygones, claimed the American and Europeans who dominated the so-called peace process. Yes, history 4,000 years ago is relevant to the future of Palestine, but history of colonization in Palestine, going back to the late 19th century, and still continues, colonization that still continues today, is, and the connection between that history and the reality unfolding in front of our eyes, were deemed by those who dominated the so-called peace industry or peace process as a waste of time and unhelpful journeys into an irrelevant past. You can read it in the, you know, even in the biographies and autobiographies of those Americans who were involved in the so-called peace process, how they blame the Palestinians for being stuck in the past, and in the same sentence justify the Zionist claim that what happened 4,000 years ago justifies the colonization of Palestine. Of course, since the brutality of Israel was undeniable, this kind of shield or this kind of antidote was not enough to justify Western indifference, that is, the bygones are bygones. You had to claim that insisting on the historical context as the only entry point for understanding the violence of either the Hamas in 2023 or the Israeli genocide in its wake, you had to insist that such a demand to look at the historical context before making a moral judgment of what happened, you had to insist in order to shield Israel that this is an act of anti-Semitism or Holocaust denial. And in some places, it is even articulated in such a way. For instance, in the directive that German university get, you are not allowed to talk about historical context when you are analyzing what happened in the last 3 years in Palestine. And even we in British university know the pressures we get from the pro-Israeli lobby, claiming that if we provide a context to the Hamas attack and the Israeli reaction, we are immediately branded as anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers. I'm not underestimating the difficulties that politicians face in the world with dealing with Israel. In reconciling a state that in the political scene of the West is defined as the only democracy in the Middle East, a high-tech and military power, with a vibrant LGBTQ scene in Tel Aviv and successful appearances both on the OECD and Eurovision charts. Well, it's very difficult to undermine this image And how do you reconcile that image with the image that emerges from leading international human rights report, including by two Israeli human rights reports from the scholarly community and the United Nations that frame the country as an apartheid state? How do you reconcile the image and the reality? And of course, what really will trouble every Palestinian friend I have is that Palestinians have argued this for decades. And of course, nobody listened to them. But now that other non-Palestinian are arguing the same, suddenly there is a clash between the image in Western politics and the reality on the ground. Another shield of trying to reconcile the image and the reality was to claim that the brutality and violence are either acts of self-defense, as we heard from Israel when he talks about the genocide in Gaza, and when this was too unreal to accept because the scenes, the images, were beyond explanation as self-defense, then you had to say that these were exceptions that do not prove the rule. Instead, of course, of seeing that the violence, for what it really is, the principal method of implementing an immoral, an impractical, an unsustainable project of imposing a European Jewish state at the heart of the Arab world at the expense of the Palestinians with the aim of displacing and replacing them. This can only be done by brutality that had to escalate when it met later on the violence of the anti-colonialist movement. But these are not the kind of analyses that we are seeing. The figures of recent polls in Israel show you how wrong it is to assume that what we see is an exception and not the rule. It shows how inherently racist is the Israeli Jewish society, that these horrific policies are really fundamental features of the Zionist state and not actually exceptional attitudes and policies of that or other government of Israel or the actions or the views of a marginal political movement. 93% of the Israeli Jews supported the genocide. Similar numbers support the assault on Iran. There is no official figures for how many Israeli Jews support the treatment of political prisoners, the harassing of and killing of farmers in the West Bank, the people of South Hebron, the dwellers of refugee camps in the West Bank, and above all, the continued actions against the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. And one can add to it the treatment of the activists in the last flotilla that came to try and help the people in Gaza. We do not have polls for how these actions are perceived by the vast majority of Israeli Jews, but it would be beyond belief if the level of support would be and it would not be similar to the one for the genocide and the other actions I have just mentioned. At one point last month, there were 6 million people in the Middle East that became refugees because of Israel. Does this mass dispossession has anything to do with the core idea of Zionism? It's a question at times that we are not allowed to ask. We're very lucky that I'm asking this question and you're still here and I'm still here. God knows with this government and the next government you have if this would be possible. So let's enjoy this freedom for a moment of asking, is the problem Zionism? It became became like the worst kind of anti-Semitism is to raise questions against Zionism. Does this mass dispossession that we are viewing today, so many people are without their homes, is it not because of the core idea of Zionism? A project of Jewish settlers encouraged by Europe and later the United States to settle in Palestine, replace and displace the Palestinians so that the nightmare of the Holocaust could come to a closure. There was, of course, a different way of dealing with that nightmare. And the Holocaust was a nightmare. The whole Second World War mass killing of people, not just Jews, millions of other people were slaughtered. There was another way of dealing with it, one that is still open, by the way. But the road was not taken. There was not one call from a European leader or European intellectual in 1945. There was not one call for the Jews of Europe to return, to stay, and rebuild a Europe that will produce antidotes to racism, fascism, and Nazism. There was no such call. But rather, all the famous intellectuals of Europe gave unconditional support to the idea of creating or building a European Jewish state outside of Europe. And Jews, first not in great number, but then quite massively, accepted the anti-Semitic notion. That's the whole idea of Zionism. They accept the anti-Semitic notion that Judaism is a race, a different nation, so that Jews cannot be Americans, they cannot be British, they cannot be German, they cannot be Moroccan, they cannot be Iraqis, because they are a different nation. And for that matter, the Jews who lived in Palestine cannot be Palestinians. And therefore, they have a moral right and material support to cede a homeland from other people to make the nation state for the Jews as a different race. For the West, in the emerging Cold War, it was important to have a Jewish state that would be the first to declare that there is a new Germany, a denazified Germany. They needed it because of the emerging Cold War. You needed West Germany to be legitimized, even before denazification of West Germany even began. But the damage was so more acute because racism in the society, in European societies, remained untouched, with the consequences clear to us today, because instead of dealing with racism, you actually pushed the most important victim of European racism outside of Europe. It was much easier in those days when the intellectual scenes was contemplating what was wrong and what was right of such a project to regard it as a huge achievement, as they wrote like this, a huge achievement of the Judeo-Christian civilization and its enemies, and an antidote to its enemies in the East, be they communists or Muslims. Had at that moment in time the West recognized the contribution of Islam to that civilization that they called the Judeo-Christian civilization, the preservation of Palestine as an Arab country connected to Islamic civilization would have been a far more just project than the idea of turning it into a European Jewish state. For Christian fundamentalists then and now, the project is an ideal twin solution for their Jewish question. The Jews are not among them, are not among their midst, because they all go to Palestine, and are part of a divine scheme that will bring back Jesus Christ, resurrect the dead, and begin a new 1,000 years of Christ's reign in the world. Even before the genocide, the Gaza Strip exposed the cynicism of the military industry and its role as another shield that was meant to prevent a discussion of a situation that is not complex and is quite straightforward, unlike the claim of the Israeli propaganda. The military industry, it seems, was not content with testing cutting-edge lethal weapons by exporting them to post-colonial areas of feuds and conflicts or ruthless police forces. The real theater where you could test the efficiency of weapons was the Gaza Strip. And not surprising, the genocide increased dramatically the Israeli military arms sales, as it did before that in 2014 and in 2009. The epicenter, however, has exposed also an alternative way forward. First and foremost, it showed the gap between Palestine as a symbol of justice and liberation in the eyes of millions of people in the world, and the pro-Israeli stances of the political elites and mainstream media. This gap is not limited to a disagreement between electorates or civil society, societies and their government of what should be the policy towards Israel. It is a symptom of the gap between the civil societies and the governments on most issues that have a moral dimension or a justice element in them. It relates to government's policy towards global warming, towards refugees, towards poverty, healthcare, education, and making ends meet to have reasonable life on this globe. A growing understanding that there is a connection between the fact that 72 million children in this world do not have any access to education and the dismal condition of your own education system is an important recognition of this gap between politics from above and the concern of the society at large. That there is a connection between the indifference to the Palestinians and to the homeless in one's own society. That there is a connection between supporting the state of Israel with arms and high tech and financial aid and the privatization of what should be public services and the slave markets of the multinational corporation, the gig economy of the transit drivers, the expulsion of immigrants from the United States and the brutality of the police. And all of this and the toleration of the immiseration and carnage in Palestine. These things are connected. They are not connected in our mind. They are connected in the real world. There is a need for a new kind of politics and a new kind of politicians, less self-centered and not ones who view the electorate as a ticket to a fresh or continued political career, but as vocation, responsibility, without outraged salaries and pension deals, as if they were managing a huge multinational corporation and not representing the people of the country. This other kind of politics would have stood idle, I believe, would not have stood idle, I believe, in the face of the most televised genocide in our times. And where would these politicians come from, is a good question. And I have a hope. I have a hope that the students, and I ask myself, will the students who participated in the encampments in the campuses in solidarity with Palestine, the young people who marched in their millions for Palestine, who escalated their solidarity in actions such as Palestine Action, or boarded the flotilla to Gaza, will be they one day politicians not in marginal positions in parties, but with the power to make change? We have to believe that they will be. Otherwise, not only Gazans, not only Palestinians, not only Lebanese would continue to suffer, but also the world would be unable to collaborate on challenges that cannot be faced by one state alone, be it global warming, poverty, migration, or so on. We need more than just a new kind of politics. We need to ask why the courageous revolutionary movements of Occupy Wall Street, the Arab Spring movement, did not materialize into effective political movements. The answer is twofold in my mind. One has to do with the toxic impact of the established left parties on the revolutionary scene's possibility in the left, the social democratic parties of the West, and the establishment of the Democratic Party in the United States that became diet ring wing parties in order to win the center in politics and chasing out those who demanded genuine socialist agenda. Not surprising, people who also identify openly and clearly with the cause of Palestine, which gave, of course, the excuse for people to oust them from such social democratic parties as anti-Semitic or, if they were Jewish, as self-hating Jews. These parties are not the solution or an alternative to the kind of politics that poisons us today. Then there is the more authentic left that ideologically and historically always made the connection between socio-economic justice and Palestine, and yet still has not found a way to replicate the coalition that ad hoc brings millions to demonstrate for Palestine, but cannot be replicated into a seriously political force that can be a powerful, transformative political factor or movement. This requires soul searching, even in that part of the left, about lofty secular positions, misaddressing and misunderstanding the power of identity politics in the Arab world in general, and in the Levant, what we call in Arabic the Mashrik in particular, that is Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. Only a dialogical front of religious and secular people, people of the left, and liberals with a modicum of humanity, green or otherwise, will be powerful enough to change politics from within, and as a consequence, adopt a policy that through sanctions and pressure would save at least the lives of thousands of Palestinians in the future. For a more fundamental change, for a decolonized, for a de-Zionized Palestine, we need changes in so many places, but I will just mention few of them. And I'm talking about not pressuring Israel to stop the carnage, but changing fundamentally the reality in Palestine and making it a free country from the river to the sea as part of a liberation and decolonization process. For that, we need an Iran that rids itself from its dismal human rights record. We need a new Arab world that navigates as it used to before the arrival of imperialism within the rich mosaic of groups that are there, some of them ethnocultural, some of them are religious on the one hand, and the need of people to live reasonable life. There are too many millions of people who are hungry and angry in the Arab world to make it an effective force of changing the reality. An Arab world that infused modernity with giving up the connection to the, without giving up, I'm sorry, infused modernity without giving up the connection to its Islamic heritage and civilization. A world that hoped that newly founded nation states will offer economic welfare and individual freedoms. This transition from the past at the end of the Ottoman Empire was never allowed to mature and develop. It needed time, it needed sensitivity, it needed nuances. You don't move from one period in history to another with all the influences from inside and outside. But this process of transition was not allowed to mature by the arrival of imperialism and Zionism, especially when Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria were targeted by imperialism, and Palestine, of course, by Zionism. When they interfered, and they had, of course, they have done it in alliance, unfortunately, with local individuals and movement who wished to dominate and control after the Ottomans rather than sustain the fragile but durable, genuine coexistence of groups, faiths, and identities. And there's no better example than Palestine before 1948, when Muslim Christians and Jews coexisted. We're not romanticizing, we're not idealizing this coexistence, we are talking about it as a normal coexistence, when there is no existential danger to anyone. And therefore, yes, you can deal with the troubles that come in with a normal human society. But normal life, with all its problems, is something, ironically, Palestinians are craving for in the last 120 years. They want to have the normal problems of a human society. They're not even allowed to have that. With the exposure of these extensive cracks in the internal system, in the international system, I'm sorry, also the cracks of the foundation of the State of Israel were exposed. The tragedy of Gaza is also a moment of opportunity because of that. History is not linear. History is cyclic. And once foundations have so much rot in them, they will collapse. But this could lead to more misery unless we recognize What should fill the void that such inevitable disintegration would bring with it? Not only in Gaza, not only in Palestine, but in many, many parts of the world. I would end by saying that if anybody thinks that you could limit the damage and the carnage and the destruction that are being now experienced by millions of people in Palestine, in Lebanon, in South Syria, if you think that you can limit that suffering to that part of the world alone, you are wrong. And I hope that even the modicum of kind of manifest, or even the manifestation which was not totally appreciated, that a war in the Gulf impacts the standard of living in the West, maybe will increase the realization that the future of the world, its economy, its social cohesion, its ability to deal with challenges such as global warming is connected to the world's attitude towards Palestine and Israel. And this is something that goes back to the fact that the world had decided that Palestine is such an important place, that is, the Western world decided that Palestine was such an important place that it had to be the place where Europe solves its own problems. Well, if they want, and I'm sure no Palestinians would object to it, if they want to let Palestine, the Palestinians, to have Palestine, the Palestinians would be the first one to be happy to say to the world, it's fine for us not to be connected to your problems, to your agenda, but you never allowed us such an independence. And as a good friend of mine used to say, and with this I would end, when I asked her, what would you think Palestinians will do if we are right and one day Palestine would be liberated and free? And she said, we will close the doors for 2 years and we ask no one to come and visit us, no one to come and help us. We just want to be with ourselves for 2 years and to feel what does it mean really to be free and independent. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ilan. This is was an amazing talk.
Thank you.
Both very insightful and incisive, but also hopeful, and sort of charts a map for how we can not just have a decolonized, de-Zionized Palestine, but a more just world, the whole wide world. I will take questions.
Can I just start off by thanking you for being a light in darkness?
Thank you.
You've been an inspiration to so many people in Iran. Just coming back to what you said, I mean, there's so many strands of the history of the occupation. I wonder if you could say a bit more about the significance of imperialism and particularly the importance of oil in the Middle East and the way that Western imperialism has therefore supported the Zionist cause. My own view is that without oil in the Middle East, Zionism wouldn't exist these days, not in the form it is. I'd be interested in your view on that.
I do think that, of course, oil plays a very important role in the, especially the American, but not only the American, not only involvement in the Middle East, but the wish to be a dominant economic and political force. However, I think that what is so unique about the Zionist project is that in order to make what, you know, for me looks almost an impossible project when it was first suggested, you needed a very powerful coalition to make it a reality, and you needed even a more powerful coalition to sustain it. And the coalition could not have been made only by people who thought that Israel is a financial asset or a factor that would ensure benefits in the field of energy, fossil energy, or petrol, and so on. You needed far more than that to make such a project a reality. You needed Christian fundamentalists who thought that Israel has to exist because they believed really that this is something that is part of a divine scheme. And do remember the politicians in the late 19th century that were willing to push Britain to occupy Palestine, and not only to occupy Palestine, to make Palestine a Jewish state. Some of them were Christian fundamentalists belonging to evangelical Christians. So it was not just economic interest. There was also ideological interest. And then you have something that is not necessarily connected to petrol, the arms industry, the securitization industry, even the pharmaceutical multinational corporation are very much vested in Israel, because the Israeli politicians are willing again and again to use the Israeli population as experiment for new drugs and so on. So you have to examine this international coalition, this powerful coalition, and understand that this is what really the Palestinians are facing. Not just the military power of Israel, but the international coalition behind that military power. And I believe this coalition is weakening. And I believe members of this coalition, not necessarily for moral reasons, even for cynical reasons, do not regard Israel anymore as an asset, but as a liability. You can still use the petroleum of the Middle East without Israel. There are enough greedy people in the Arab world who would make sure that petrol gets to America even without normalizing relationship with Israel, certainly after the bombing of their countries by Iran in the last few months.
Can we have this lady, please?
Thank you so much. You gave an excellent podcast with the Makdizi brothers.
Right.
You mentioned that even if Israel expands the Litani River and they take that land, that diplomacy will not be possible, that they will continue with an expansionist project. And the same with the Yellow Line in the Gaza Strip. It is an expansionist project. So I guess my question is, what is your view, I guess, on the chance for diplomacy? And if there is no chance for diplomacy in this case because it's an expansionist project, what are the options for politicians in terms of sanctions, the boycott movement, if diplomacy in the regular sense won't work with an expansionist project?
There is no chance for diplomacy, as I said in that podcast, but also in other places. The reason is that even the more genuine participants in the diplomatic efforts in what is called the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestine issue still believe that their role, if they are Europeans or Americans or Canadians or whatever, that they believe their role is to mediate, that the two sides cannot come together unless they offer their mediation services. You know, I met a lot of young civil servants in about four or five foreign ministries in Europe in the last few months. And what was characteristic of these young people, they were members of a section in the foreign ministry that was called the Middle East Peace Process. So I asked them, do you understand that you are in a section of nothing and anything, and it doesn't bode well for you that your colleagues thought that this is the section you belong to? The director of the section, when always I say this, says, now it's time for lunch. Because I think some cases it's she, sometimes it's him, realized that this is true. So diplomacy depends what we mean by this. If diplomacy is used to save the Palestinians, to defend the Palestinians, yes, there is a role for diplomacy. If diplomacy continues to play the game, what is needed is mediation, then it provides, intentionally or unintentionally, immunity for Israel to continue its policies of genocide in Gaza, of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, and intimidating the region as a whole.
I would like to know, what is your position or your analysis about censorship, and how far are, like, with new technologies, are we like from technified censorship from states that are alienated to the Zionism rhetorics or narratives?
Now, this is an interesting question, because I'm not terribly sure that this censorship is working once it moved to alternative media and the cyberspace. You know, I tortured readers with a 500-page book on lobbying for Zionism. And if anybody of you bought the book and read it, I apologize both for the price and the time that you have invested in a 500-page book. But what I came to conclusion that would save you, for those of you who don't want to invest in my future, the bottom line was that the lobby is very good in pressuring mainstream media, established media, political elites. It found it very difficult to challenge civil society. You can cause community centers to be shut. You can intimidate universities, you can intimidate churches and so on. But it's less effective than intimidating a politician by saying to him or her, we will support your rival if you will not support our cause. And I think in a similar way, it's too much of a fluid water to be contained. And you can, you know, on the one hand, yes, there is attempt to, of course, to use the Israeli connection to Meta, to Microsoft, and so on. And they will do all they can, of course, to make sure that they think that this would be good enough tool to somehow make the images that this alternative media brought to public attention, the information that was brought to public attention, disappear. I don't believe it will work. First of all, because the already information is there. So you can close it, but it's there. Secondly, this is for me, it's the inevitable pathological phase Israel has arrived at. We have about 1,000 clips of Israeli soldiers from Gaza documenting some of the worst things that they did to the people of Gaza. They documented it. They decided to share it with the world. So what would the censor do? You see, I think that we have to realize this. People say it's a different Israel. I say this is the inevitable Israel, but that's a different discussion now. What is not debatable is that this is an Israel that doesn't care about international law, that is not afraid of public opinion, that is not afraid of condemnation, that still, when its own citizens say, you know, but we are being thrown out of restaurants, from taxis, we are unwelcome, they still are happy to believe their government's explanation that this is just a continuation of anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews. Not everyone buys it. Unfortunately, those Israelis who don't buy it choose to leave rather than to create an anti-Zionist movement. But this is changing as well. I mean, there is a growing willingness, I think, to challenge Zionism also from within Jewish communities, and that is very promising.
I want to ask, you mentioned about the role of the European Union and the sort of the Western hegemonic powers in supporting Israel. Now, I want to add something to that. So I am from India, and I know that how much the Indian state is pro-Israel and how it uses Israel's action on Palestine to oppress the Muslim minorities in its own country. So I was wondering, do you see sort of a shift or an additional effort by Israel right now to also build narrative amongst sort of the post-colonial countries, other post-colonial countries? Because it's really worrying to see how can one nation, which is post-colonial itself, can support such a violent colonizing action of another state. So if you can comment a bit about Israel's role on narrative building in the post-colonial world. Yeah.
Yeah. It is true that Israel, as I said before, you need all the time to have an international coalition. It's not enough to have the military power. The military imbalance is certainly in Israel's favor, militarily, economically, and so on, vis-a-vis the Palestinian, not vis-a-vis the Arab world, but vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So you need an international coalition. So if you're losing the civil society in the West, you are trying to get the coalition elsewhere. That, hence Israeli connection with Somaliland. hence the Israeli investment in Chinese universities, hence the Israeli connection to the Christians in Malaysia, hence the connection with Modi and the great honor they bestowed upon him at the midst of the genocide in the Israeli Knesset. Why post-colonial societies, or states rather, are willing to go along with this? Well, I think Frantz Fanon already warned us that the fact that you are decolonizing physically a country doesn't mean that you are decolonizing it mentally, psychologically, or culturally. And some of the post-colonial states that emerged after liberation were not better than the colonized states, unfortunately, in so many cases. This explains, by the way, why so much hope is pinned on a future Palestinian state, because it's probably the only part that was not even physically decolonized in the world. So yes, I do think that it shows the global connection I was talking about, namely that India is ruled by BJP, by Hindu fanatic nationalism, is connected to the fact that Palestine is not liberated. The problem is, how do we make people see it? How can people understand that there is a connection between a place that was not even decolonized physically and a place that was decolonized physically but is not totally decolonized in any other place? So I think there is this need to integrate the conversation into the global kind of level for it to become effective both for India and for Palestine.
Thank you. You say that history is cyclical and not linear. In relation to colonial settlement, how does that work? Where is the circle of history, and where does it take you when you look at Australia and indigenous people there, or Native mm-hmm. Americans? Yeah. Thank you.
You know, you have to be worried when historians talk about cyclic, because for us, 150 years is a moment in history. And I think that what I really mean is, and I totally agree with Eric Hobsbawm when he had one book called The Age of Imperialism, then he had another book called The Age of Extreme. And he, as I said, he ended it in 1991. It didn't end in 1991, surely, in a place like, as you mentioned, what happened with indigenous people in Australia and so on. But it's exactly the kind of optical illusion that the institution built in 1945 created, as if the colonizer's world can tell the colonized world how it can be a better world without negotiating it with the colonized people. And again, Palestine is a prime example of it. The United Nations that decided about the establishment of Israel is a United Nations in which not one colonized nation was presented. And when colonized nations were presented in the United Nations in 1975, the United Nations General Assembly, the same General Assembly, passed the resolution that Zionism is racism. That's what happens when you include everyone in this. So I think this is the cycle that began with the big age of imperialism. And we're still in many ways in that cycle. I do believe it's coming to an end, because look what happened when the President of the United States, when Israel, for instance, and they are not the only ones, are violating totally the international law and regulation. It collapses the whole system. It wasn't there before because of this illusion that there were regulations that should prevent that. That should prevent it. It's happening in front of our eyes. I believe in humanity. That's my problem, maybe. I do believe that people would wake up and say, no, it's impossible even for us as Americans to be part of a state that acts like a group of robbers and hijacks and abducts people who are leaders, bombs countries at will, and so on. Somehow this uninhibited brutality would have consequences. And I can point out to some of these consequences. They're already happening, but we don't realize, I think, the potential that they have to be more transformative. If you would have told me 10 years ago that in the biggest Jewish city in the world, the electorate would choose a Muslim mayor who's known for his support of Palestine, I would ask you what kind of pills you've taken that morning. I would not have believed you that this would be possible. If you would have told me that in order to become the next candidate of the Democratic Party in the United States, you don't anymore have to show loyalty to Israel, which was the precondition. You have to show, even if it would be a bit misguided and not real, but you would have to show at least some compassion for the Palestine cause. Again, if you would have told me that this would be a precondition to become the candidate for the Democratic Party, I would not have believed that. Or if you would have told me that millions of people would demonstrate for Palestine, all these things are precursors, I believe, of something more powerful that will happen and will come. I remember the 1970s. It was impossible to have a demonstration for Palestine with more than 500 people. And we had 500 people, we thought, this is a mass demonstration. And then suddenly you come to London and 1 million people demonstrate for Palestine. These are not incidents in history. They are precursors of something that can happen. Of course, can happen. It depends on us.
I wanted to ask what a decolonized Palestine or Israel or Middle East looks like in the future. You said you can imagine it, and I think there are about 7.5 million Jews living there, and about the same amount of Muslims and non-Jews. So what would that look like after decolonization? Yeah.
In my book, Israel on the Brink, I imagine exactly the kind of Israel that would be after liberation. And I say in the book that one of the most important questions the Palestinian National Movement would have to ask is how does it see the future of 8 million Jews in such a country? And I think what I gather from, and I build the answer from what I hear from young Palestinians, is that if Jews would be willing to live in a proper democracy on the basis of equality, based on restorative justice that allows the refugees to return, redistributes the resources, if this kind of post-Israel, Israel if you want, or post-Israel-Palestine, is something the Jews are willing to share, or when Arab Jews would recognize that they are Arabs and not just Jews, and would have no worries of being connected to their own language, heritage, and history, then of course this is possible for them. But in the book, I'm very realistic. I have an imagined conversation between a grandfather and a grandson, a Jewish grandfather and a Jewish grandson, in which the grandson asks the grandfather, what happened to all the Jews who lived in our street? What, that is after liberation. And the grandfather says, I'm sorry that they have left. They decided that if Israel is not an apartheid state, they can't live there. And that happened in South Africa. White people in South Africa, some of them came to the West Bank because they were looking for another apartheid system. So this is not going to be a walk in the, it's not a rose, you know, it's not a very, let's put it this way. Decolonization is not a nice process in history. Well, we have to hope that it would be less violent as possible, less painful as possible. I think most Israelis that have been able to liberate themselves from indoctrination and propaganda know that the basic Palestinian impulse from the very beginning was not retribution, was not revenge, was just to have normal life. Palestinians are so eager to share normal life with the Israelis. Even the 48 Arabs who live today in Israel are willing to be part of the Israeli political system, are willing to be part of the Israeli government. And Israeli racism, even on the left, says to them, no, you cannot be part of the government. You cannot have equal rights. And that is something that would have to change. And if people would not want to change it, it's not a precondition for liberation. Their willingness is not a precondition for liberation.
My question is, without Russia's influence, people in Gaza, Palestine, Western Bank, do you think they could live with Israel peacefully?
Russia is playing a very marginal role in the Palestinian resistance. It used to play a very important role in the 1970s and 1980s. So the answer to your question is that even if Russia would not have been involved, the two things would continue to happen. The Zionist state would still look for ways of having as much of Palestine with as few Palestinians as possible, because that's the nature of Zionist ideology. And secondly, the Palestinians would continue to resist and be resilient as much as they can in front of this project of elimination that they have been facing since the late 19th century.
You discussed what changes are needed for a decolonized Palestine, and could you develop on how you perceive the role in this of the axis of resistance, and particularly Iran? Because you mentioned it, but you didn't really explain what is their role.
As for the question of Iran, what I meant to say is that, you know, and I always have these conversations with people who are dissidents of the current Iranian regime on the left, that somehow they feel it's impossible to get a sophisticated position by which you are condemning the violations of human rights of your own country, and yet you are able to appreciate that it's standing against the attempt to eliminate and destroy the Palestinians. It does need a certain complicated position, undoubtedly. And what I say is that we shouldn't be in that complicated position. It's not mutually exclusive to demand very strongly and sternly that the dismal human rights record of Iran should change, and to demand that the genocide of the Palestinians should end. These are not mutually exclusive demands, and there's something far more important. Because the United States plays such a destructive role in the Middle East, and because we do believe that the less it is involved, the better the future of the area would be, the regional powers such as Turkey and Iran and Egypt can all play a far more constructive way, both in the case of Palestine, but also in the case of the Arab world as a whole. I didn't have time to go into it because there's a limit to how much you can squeeze in one lecture. But one of the preconditions for a free Palestine is also the total collapse, in a way, of the nation-state system that the colonialist powers have built after the First World War in the Eastern Mediterranean. And for that, you need the Arab political regimes, the Arab political elites, and the Middle Eastern political elites, not just the Arab ones, Iran and Turkey as well, to be part of a conversation of how you probably still retain some of the nation states, you can't have a total collapse, but go back to these, what Osama Magdisi calls the genuine coexistence between the various groups and so on. So I think that we can demand both, but we also have to distinguish between what is urgent and what needs a more strategic approach.
I just wanted to go back to the beginning of your talk when you said that we should appeal to what is left, which is a sense of morality, and I'm just wondering whether or not, well, what do we do when there is no sense of morality? Because I think a lot of intellectuals, as well as politicians, are less interested in morality, but more interested in mathematics, or worse, they assume that morality is mathematics.
Yeah.
They're more interested in numbers than anything else, and I don't understand how we can appeal to this.
Yeah. One of the reasons that you are encountering this, and I know because I gave a keynote speech to the American Philosophical Society and I encountered exactly what you're talking about. I think we forget what happened to what we call intellectuals. They became academics. And academics became member of an organization that is less and less concerned with knowledge production and education and far more with research grants and profits and deficits. And because of that, also the academics who should write about moral issues are also, on the one hand, are members of a scholarly community and feel, of course, the need to comply with what is expected of them in terms of moral philosophy, but they're also members of an institution that is run like a financial company. And therefore, there is a limit for the moral criticism if it can affect your own promotion and your own career. And you know, moral courage can be an oxymoron in the case of academics. And they are much more likely, and I don't blame them because it's really tough life, can be also moral cowardice. And if you remember, moral cowardice or moral panic, as Stanley Cohen, the sociologist, used to define it, moral panic is when, on the one hand, you have very strong beliefs, you know, kind of principles that you preach, you write about, you research, but you have to implement them yourself, they become less relevant because they are too dangerous, and maybe seriously dangerous. I mean, you can lose your job, you can be suspended, and so on. So I think that this is connected to the way, and I will finish because I think there's a good example for that. The way academia in this country, for instance, deals with Palestine and the less of respect in the government towards that part of the academia that deals with Palestine is very interesting. When the British government is trying to formulate a policy about global warming, at least it makes the effort to talk to the main experts in the academia about global warming. I don't know if they listen to them, but at least they are meeting them. When they are proscribing pro-Palestinian groups or Palestinian groups as terrorist groups, they don't consult one academic who's an expert on Palestine, one academic who's an expert on solidarity movements, and they only consult the Israeli Secret Service of what to do. And I think this is something that shows total disrespect to us as academics, as experts. And unfortunately, we earned this disrespect because we don't insist that this is something that should be appreciated and our voice should be heard because we know better than the government what is a liberation movement, what is an anti-colonialist movement. And we are not, hopefully, as afraid as they are of lobbyists and advocacy group that condemn them as anti-Semitic, and they fall into this trap by believing that this is really what they are or that they can affect their political career. So we have a role to play in the academia that would bring us self-respect, first of all, before we demand respect from others. Thank you.
Thank you all so much.